Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We're going to have to start with multiple trigger warnings here. We are going to be joined by Rick Wilson, who's coming back on the podcast. So there may be F-bombs. This may be an explicitly rated podcast. I just want to put that up front for those of you driving around in your car with your nine-year-old. Second trigger warning, I guess I realized over the last several weeks that Democrats don't like to be told that sometimes they're bad at politics. And one of the reasons I think they're bad at politics is because they never like to be told they're bad at politics. But there's so much going on. So welcome back to the Bulwark Podcast, Rick Wilson.
Charlie, thanks for having me back, man. I appreciate it.
Okay, so mood, where are we at here, Rick?
You know, I wrote in one of my first book that Democrats were holistically bad at politics.
I was thinking about that.
And I can't tell you the number of Democrats who've been like, shut up, Bushy.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait. I'm like a walk-in during the Cold War. I'm like a Soviet, you know, KGB general who walks into your fucking embassy during the Cold War and says, hey, I've got a briefcase full of secrets. Yeah. I'm going to tell you where your weak spots are. The response isn't fuck you, shut up.
Yeah.
It's, hey, let's talk.
Yeah.
And, you know, I say this a lot. Tough love is still love. And I've tried to give our Democratic friends some tough love. There are days that I just wake up and think, the next time I hear a Democrat say that we're going to win in 2022 on infrastructure and climate, I'm going to take them into a dark alley and beat them to death with a lead pipe, because it's obviously the only fucking solution to get it through their heads that they have to nationalize this election right now. They have to campaign on, you know, the existential crisis of, do you want the crazy and the authoritarian, or do you want America?
Yeah.
It's that simple.
You know, and this is the reality check. Look, there was a little bit of hubris earlier in the year where Democrats were talking about this transformational period. They were going to be like FDR, and maybe more people should have raised the red flag and said, would you kind of look at the scoreboard here? You really don't have a working majority in the United States.
Right.
Senate number two, you have like, what, 3-5 vote margin in the House. You just did not win enough elections. And if you are reckless and you screw this up, because this is your one job, right? Do not fuck it up. If you do, then you're going to be losing a lot more elections. And the control of the House is not going to be determined by whether, you know, AOC gets, you know, 70% or 72%, it's going to be determined by the moderates. So pay attention to the moderates as opposed to burning all of your bridges.
You know, it was funny because she AOC at one point tweeted, she was talking smack about Lincoln Project at one point. She's like, take the L, Lincoln Project. You did nothing. And I'm thinking, her PAC has supported like 47 candidates in the last couple of years and like three have won. Get the fuck out of here. I get that she's a superstar on the left, and I get that they love her, and I get that she is a brilliant social media strategist and brilliant social media character. It's great. I got no hate for that. Okay. God bless. Do your thing. But operational politics in this country, it is the most precious illusion of the Democratic Party that I've observed this over 30 years of doing this. They honestly believe in an ideological homogeneity across the whole country.
Yeah.
And they think, you know, they think that Eau Claire, Wisconsin is just full of progressives waiting to hear the right 600-page climate plan to come roaring out into the and change the ball game. Or that you know, it, with just the right amount of Green New Deal or paid daycare or some mojo policy thing, that it's going to change the country. And they walk onto the battlefield consistently and not understand that the Republicans are going to wage a culture war against them, generally successfully, because the whole country is largely center-ish with a rightward, slightly rightward tilt. It is, I mean, if you're going to aggregate the whole thing, we have 25 miles of coastal liberalism and a country that's largely center-right in the middle. Now, I will say this: the Trumpers and the neo Bannonites and the whatever the fuck those people are now, they also disregard or misunderstand the country, thinking that America's just ready for spiffy uniforms and white purity and school prayer, you know, thinking that the whole country is basically like ass crack Alabama. They are mistaken in that regard as well. But you know, what do I know? It's enormously frustrating right now to watch the Democratic Party not understand the Republicans are busy nationalizing this election. Nationalizing it on a bunch of different spaces.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about the border. We could talk about crime. We could talk about fiscal responsibility, whatever. So let's talk about the moment of brinksmanship here. And I guess I've watched this so many times that I kind of know that, you know, in the end, no, we're not going to default on our debt. You know, there's going to be a lot of demagoguery and a lot of back and forth, and it's going to be messy and it's going to be embarrassing. But you know, they'll find a way to raise the debt limit. You know, despite the just crass irresponsibility of Mitch McConnell and the Republicans. I mean, put a marker right here? Mitch McConnell saying we're not going to provide any votes to raise the debt, which he knows is irresponsible, but he also knows that he will pay no political price for it. They've internalized this, right? That they can be as reckless as possible, but when the Democrats run anything, they know that no matter how bad things get, they won't be blamed for it, really. I mean, they'll be blamed on Twitter and on cable television, but they'll be, you know, and so Mitch McConnell feels that he has no responsibility whatsoever.
That's the beauty of the modern Republican Party. And this is an analogy that not everybody will get, but this is like the summer of 68 for the Republican Party. But in this case, they're the hippies. They're living on a bus somewhere. They have no jobs. They have no responsibilities. They have nobody to answer to. They hope mom and dad keep sending money. They're living this free lifestyle. They don't have anything to be responsible for except owning the libs and churning out the next email based on their lightest Fox News hit. That's their world. There's nothing. This country yeah. could burn to the goddamn ground, and Mitch McConnell will laugh all the way down. He doesn't care. And that's the thing. McConnell himself has never been particularly ideological. McConnell is a guy who believes in the pure exercise of power.
Sure.
And he's very, very good at it. I mean, let's not mistake. Democrats, if you flip the script and put Chuck Schumer where Mitch McConnell is, Mitch McConnell would still have all the power he has right now. He can operate from the minority or the majority and exercise power. The Democrats in the majority, they stare at themselves and go, well, you know, what we've got to do is pass an infrastructure bill. That'll change the ball game. What the hell, people? Okay, and everybody listening, arguendo, yes, we could use an infrastructure bill. The roads suck. The bridges suck. Blah, 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 blah. Washington, D.C. consultants produce these endless policy loops, and they go and they focus group, and say, would you like more a shiny new bridge in you know, Orlando, Florida, whatever? People go, yeah, I'd love that. I love the infrastructure bill. That'd be a great idea. And then when they vote on personality, they vote on sure. culture, they vote on politics, they vote on the fit of the candidate to their lifestyle and their ideas about what they want in Washington or Tallahassee or Madison or wherever. And again,
there's a disconnect. Yeah.
If you don't nationalize this election early, as the Republicans are trying to do, the Republicans would love this election to be about critical race theory.
Sure. The border.
Antifa, the mm-hmm. border, mm-hmm. Afghanistan, and some lurid crime. Anti-crime thing that is a narrow way of trying to say the N word. Never.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Haitian refugees who are, Haitian immigrants who are raping your wife and your daughter on the way to register to vote for Democrats.
Well, yeah, and you know, the one saving grace of the Haitian refugees in the minds of the Bannonites is at least they're not going to bring those dreaded taco trucks to our neighborhoods.
That's right. Well, I was promised. I like taco trucks.
I'm a huge fan.
Where are the damn taco trucks?
Bring me the taco trucks. If they want to come and send their best, they'll be sending it in a taco truck.
I would be willing to leave my basement occasionally if I knew there were more taco trucks here. Okay, so you keep saying nationalize. Okay, so what do Republicans do to counter all of that? What do Democrats do? What is their nationalization? It's not
first
going
off,
to
they
be,
have to
hey, voting rights, we didn't do that. Police reform, we didn't do that.
Right.
Right?
They have to do a couple of things, I think, in the short term. and frankly, they're gonna have to rely on a lot of outside groups to burn down the bad guys for them. Hint, hint. Yeah. One of the things I think
is
gonna happen.
Subtle.
I know. I'm very subtle. I'm very subtle. It's it's like they're staring at each other going, we don't have a chainsaw. We have to cut down these trees. Do we know with a chainsaw?
Yes.
Do we have a chainsaw guy?
And you're standing on the curb.
Look, first off, they need to stop falling into the culture war traps. Okay. The D-Trip and the DS and the Senate committee and the Democratic Party and every state Democratic chairman needs to tell every candidate, the minute you say the words defund the police, you're out. No more money, more nothing. You're done. You're over. It's done. I mean, when Jim Clyburn says defund the police is the stupidest message he's ever heard, I think you'll listen to him.
Listen to him.
On critical race theory, stop trying to explain critical race theory. Stop trying to academically select critical race theory and flip it back on the Republicans. Because here's what critical race theory really means. It's Republicans asking for permission to go back to what Lee Atwater said. They want to go back to 1958. Lee Atwater said, 1958, you could say NNN over and over again. It didn't hurt you politically. But by 1968, it hurt you. So you had to talk about crime and busing. Republicans are trying to turn that clock back so they can basically use the N-word in politics. They're trying to racialize our politics completely.
Okay, could I interrupt you now?
Yeah.
Because, I have these elaborate plans for the podcast sometime, but every once in a while we got to go with the flow because the point you're making right now, people might be thinking, okay, that's kind of an exaggeration, isn't it? You know, turning back to 1958, I, by the way, would have said 1957, but that's just me.
Close enough.
Well, last night, I mean, for people who think that this is an exaggeration, and I wrote about this in my newsletter today, you know, all the book banning that's being done around the country.
I saw that.
Any books that might make white people uncomfortable about race, this is being shut down. And part of this is that Christopher Rufo's, you know, strategy that anytime anybody sees anything they don't like, call it critical race theory. But your point is, what is the end game here? It is to provide a permission structure for Republicans not only not to talk about racial justice, but to say things that I'm sorry, it is still breathtaking for me to hear people like Tucker Carlson using what until 5 minutes ago was a neo-Nazi meme about the great replacement theory. And seriously, you know, before this year, the whole idea that black people and brown people are going to replace white people was really confined to white nationalist circles. And now Tucker Carlson he's not just dancing around anymore. He's using the term. Let me just play a clip from him. This is Tucker Carlson on Fox News last night.
An unrelenting stream of immigration. But why? Well, Joe Biden just said it. To change the racial mix of the country. That's the reason, to reduce the political power of people whose ancestors lived here and dramatically increase the proportion of Americans newly arrived from the third world. And then Biden went further. He said that non-white DNA is the, quote, source of our strength. Imagine saying that. This is the language of eugenics. It's horrifying. But there's a reason Biden said it. In political terms, this policy is called the Great Replacement, the replacement of legacy Americans with more obedient people from faraway countries.
Neo-Nazis say it.
They brag about it all the time. But if you dare to say it's happening, they will scream at you with maximum hysteria. And here you have Joe Biden confirming his motive on tape with a smile on his face.
Okay, so first of all, he uses the phrase Great Replacement. And then he talks about legacy Americans. I mean, who are the legacy Americans?
Like, you know, I'm wondering
Norwegian Americans, right?
But look, I'm a fifth generation Floridian, and I am and our people came here in the 1830s and 40s from Germany. Okay, both sides. Now, am I a legacy American? Sure, but if you were shoved onto a boat in Ghana at the slave castle and brought here, you're a goddamn legacy American too.
No kidding.
And in ways that are more burdened than my privileged upbringing. But you know, all I could think of when I listened to Tucker saying that, remember the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Sure.
And there was the one figure, he was like the local Klan leader, but he was kind of a dweeby, nerdy guy. And he comes in the room, he goes, we got some miscegenating going on in here. I mean, that's all I could think of when I was listening to that, because this is the natural extension of that, okay, is the superiority of white DNA. And it's not, remember, they used to kind of disguise it as Western culture, Western civilization. But what they're really saying now is that politics is genetically determined, that people who lack the white Anglo-Saxon or white Catholic upbringing are genetically predisposed to be liberals, and that any exaggeration of the dangers of quote unquote white replacement is countenance on a network that is run by the Murdoch family. I mean, and Lachlan is largely running the network now, increasingly running the network, and they're lucky the Fox news is still stock price or stock pool wise controlled by the Murdoch family, because if the flip side of this happened and someone was advocating for a replacement of white Americans, you know, genetically, and talking about this on any other network, they'd be fucking shut down in a hot minute. Their board would go, "What are you doing?" But Tucker Carlson is a force unto his own now inside Fox. You know, he's a future presidential candidate, most likely, and he's going to run on this platform that has not just vague origins in eugenics theory and Nazi race theory, but explicit. I mean, that shit he was talking about could have come out of the pages of Der Stürmer in 1936.
Well, and that's the thing, is there is no subtlety about it. And you look around and there's no blowback on the right. There's no Republicans that are saying, hey, you know, this is going too far. You're not hearing anything from the Fox News board. You haven't heard anything from Paul Ryan. This is how racism becomes normalized, you know. Uh-huh. And I guess part of, you know, going back to 1957 and in 1958, things were complicated back then. That's not the word I actually wanted to use there, but it's been this long struggle on the right among Republicans to come to grips with that racial legacy. I mean, there was a time when the Republicans were the pro-civil rights party.
That's right.
You know, tragically, part of the rise of the conservative movement was to turn against civil rights, but there has been this effort, and you watched it, where Republicans said, okay, we'd have to come to grips with this. We have to come up with our approach to racial justice, and we need to confront our past. And that was really gathering steam. But right now we are at a moment where not only are they not engaging in that discussion anymore, they have shut down any discussion of it. I mean, this is part of the point of the book banning, you know, and the attack on CRT, which is not about CRT at all. It's like any book that raises, you know, troublesome thing, you know, again, hurts their fragile feelings. So on the right or on the Republicans, I mean, they have just shut down 40 years of trying to come to grips with this.
Remember, the idea that the Republican Party is the one that's being canceled and culturally stifled and told to shut up is absolutely nothing more than strategic misdirection. The idea that they're being told that they can't think certain thoughts or express certain feelings, you know, Oscar Wilde once called homosexuality the sin that dare not speak its name.
Yeah.
Well, you know, with Trumpism, their oppression is the condition that can't shut its fucking mouth. They never, ever stop talking about it. They never, ever stop talking about how oppressed they are. It's their entire brand now. It's the only thing they have. There is no policy infrastructure underneath the Republican Party. When you and I were coming up in this thing, it was about individual liberty and fiscal responsibility and a muscular foreign policy and constitutional adherence and all that. And, you know, when you have a guy like J.D. Vance in Ohio saying the purpose of conservatism is to destroy the enemies of the American nation state.
What is this?
Yeah. It's just like, get the fuck out of here. Yeah. Come on. So, you know, but the strength of what they have is that they're entirely liberated from responsibility. They're never going to govern. They're never going to care. They're never going to do anything that makes them like have a moment of introspection going, hey, maybe we're fucking up the country. Maybe we shouldn't, because that would be anathema.
So going back to your point that I interrupted you on, you were saying how the Democrats need to understand the Republicans are nationalizing this election and they need to do it. And part of that is pushing back on the embrace of this kind of racialized politics. just talk to me about that a little bit, because I mean, obviously, that's going to undermine Republicans in among suburban voters. But I wonder whether or not it would further entrench this politics of racial identity. Whether Steve Bannon would go, yeah, I want to have a discussion about that. Yeah, let's go.
Look, race is the sort of constant undercurrent under the thread inside American politics for a very long time. But they will welcome the opportunity to use all the old, to go back to the greatest hits and all the old code word stuff. And, you know, and CRT is just the new version of busing. And crime is still, you know, their new version of black people are coming to rape your family and burn your house down and take your money. That's a song they've been playing for a very, very long time.
Although, look, I mean, you know, crime is a legitimate concern. And I think we saw that in the New York election where African-Americans were like, screw that, defund the police. I want police protecting me. And it's
right. There is a difference. There is a distinction in the minds of, again, this is that reality bubble that people who live within 25 miles of the coast on both sides of the country frequently mistake. When you live in a gated community somewhere, you're not really worried about crime. You've moved away from it. You've secured yourself from it. But this goes to part of the argument about guns. You know, about 35% of the gun owners in Florida are African American, mm-hmm. and they're not committing crimes with them. They're trying to keep themselves safe. They're trying to keep Democrats, not African Americans.
Yeah, right.
And that number tends to be more African American. We did a few years ago, we pulled the Florida voter file and compared it with the concealed carry permit data. And like I said, about 35% are Democrats. A huge number of African Americans are firearms owners. And it's like the Democrats can't understand what motivated that. It's because, yes, they're afraid of the police in a lot of areas, you know, having a disproportionate and evil, you know, approach to the way they treat African American folks in the criminal justice system. But it's also because they don't feel like they're safe. And if you say defund the police, you open a space for a Mitch McConnell candidate to pretend to not be crazy, to pretend to not be evil.
That's over.
And to say, I just want to keep you safe.
Yeah, no, that should be a no-brainer. So Joe Biden is getting ripped from both the left and the right, going back to this question of how you nationalize. Because right now, on the border, he's being ripped by people who say that he's not being tough enough. He's being ripped by progressives who think he's being too aggressive. On the issue of infrastructure, you know, you actually have, they're like on the one inch line of passing that $1 trillion infrastructure bill, which mm-hmm. at one time we thought was a lot. And yet you have the real men of political genius, like Wisconsin's own Mark Pocan, progressive, who went on CNN last night and said there will be 50 Democrats who will vote against the bipartisan bill on Monday. Unless the larger reconciliation bill has been approved. I mean, it's like, this is, we're seeing this sort of brinksmanship here.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, I get a lot of blowback saying, no, it's the moderates who are trying to blow things up. No, you have a win in hand. You have this bill. You pass this bill. You put it on Joe Biden's desk. You know, you at least have the narrative that you got something done. You follow the Mark Pocan. No, we are going to blow ourselves up. I'm going to take this hammer and smash my own head if I don't get $3.5 trillion. That just feeds the narrative of a failed presidency and absolutely guarantees that Republicans are going to say, hey, you need to vote for us because, look, everything's falling apart under this guy, right?
They will portray the moment we are in as the existential crisis, the worst moment, the plunge that, you know, seconds away from the cliff, et cetera.
Democrats need wins.
Yeah, they need some wins, but they also need to push back on some of the bullshit too. And this is a very harsh way of putting this. Mm-hmm. Americans didn't care for basically 20 years what was happening in Afghanistan, even though we were there. Mm-hmm. They didn't care. And since the death of bin Laden, they really haven't cared. I suspect Afghanistan will not be the issue for Republicans that they think it is. There's broad public approval of the policy. What Biden needs to look out for are things that produce great panicky Fox coverage over a long period of time. So the Haitian crisis on the border, they need to resolve it.
It's horrific.
It's bad optics. It's bad everything. And I hate the word optics. I try not to use it, but it's a bad picture.
It allows,
you know, even though they are busily deporting these folks, because they're not covered under the exception, it allows Bannon and it allows the Fox complex, it allows Breitbart and all the other idiots in the mutant parade of Republican media to go out and claim, you know, here comes the tidal wave of the scary brown people.
Right. This is the caravan handed to them.
Sure. And sure. It's actually a caravan.
See, you know, I think this is your point here is that it's sort of a holistic thing. So we have Afghanistan itself won't hurt Biden, but if it appears, if you get that narrative, that image of chaos, of weakness, of menace, you connect the dots. You know, the Haitian refugees, the Afghan collapse, crime in the cities. This is the way the Republicans are going to nationalize it. And Democrats need to understand that that is a playing field. And simply passing some of these spending bills, which I think are necessary, but they are far from sufficient.
It is. I could not agree more. That's the key misapprehension, is that an infrastructure bill or a spending bill will give them, quote unquote, something to run on. Just as culture wars are where Democrats go to die, policies and policy proposals and policy bills are the castles in Spain. They are imaginary in terms of the way they move voters. I promise you, absolutely zero voters will say, man, I changed my mind because of the, you know, jobs and opportunity creation provisions of House Bill, blah, blah, blah. No one will say that. It will not change a single mind. It will not alter how voters feel.
Well, but on the other hand, if the economy comes back, if the economy is strong, if they find a way to actually tamp down the pandemic, then voters will be more likely, won't they, to stay the course?
Well, look, I happen to believe COVID is the single most important political shaping factor in the coming election. The most important.
Okay.
And because it is the wellspring of all the other things that drive the wrong track numbers in the polling. And it is the thing that people feel is the uncontrollable problem. They feel like it is the thing that for all the good intentions of Biden, that we're still having deaths, we're still having infections. You know, we're still having a massive anti-vaccine movement in the country, and it makes people feel uncertain and worried. It makes female voters in particular, who tend to be, I'm not being stereotyping here, speaking from actual like research, they tend to be the ones who are the caregivers. They tend to be the ones who have borne the burden of their kids being at home for a year. And so this idea that COVID was going to be handled, and that once we got vaccinated, and maybe it would have happened if we'd gotten to the right level of vaccinations, but instead we had, you know, the jackass patrol on Fox, you know, questioning vaccines. We have a Facebook, which is really the wellspring of the problem of anti-vax. All those things added up to a position where here we are, and Delta has ripped through the country, and, you know, and we're losing people again, and we're having, and winter is coming. So we're going to end up having another season of this crap, and it's going to continue to be a sort of ongoing burden. Look, externalities in the economy are always a factor you can't really foresee. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, remember George Herbert Walker Bush came out of the Iraq War with 93% approval rate.
I do remember,
and believe me, I was working in the administration, and I watched the precipitous decline as the economy went into an extremely mild recession by current standards, and the economic panic that happened. And so, you know, you see the election of 2010 was not just because the Tea Party was this thing. It was because America felt an economic shock in 2008 and 2009 and had a response. If Biden has an uptick in the economy, which, by the way, the economy is not a disaster right now. It's actually, you know, by all the numbers, if the same numbers were here right now, the Trump administration would be putting out triumphant press releases. Mm-hmm. Okay. If the economy is steady or growing, changes the political playing field quite a lot.
Well, also, but on the pandemic, it strikes me as that this is an area where the Democrats can go on the offense that could be a very significant liability for, you know, basically point out, you know, that people like Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott have really been worse than AWOL on this particular issue. Because I sense, you know, yes, I mean, obviously there's some grassroots anger about the mandates, about mask mandates, vaccine mandates, sure. But there's also tremendous anger and a strong national consensus that this is right now a pandemic of the unvaccinated. And the people out there who have been playing games with this ought to be called on this, ought to be called over and over and over on this.
I will tell our Democratic friends a dirty little secret. None of the voters who hate mask mandates and vaccination mandates, none of those voters are gettable by you. They're gone.
Right.
They're already in the Republican camp. They're already deep in the Facebook groups that tell them to shoot up, you know, horse dewormer and take hydroxychloroquine or whatever other fanciful, you know, folk remedies their tribe uses to cure a virus that will kill them. So, most voters want to take steps to end COVID. They'll take the inconvenience in the short term for getting rid of a deadly pandemic that has killed 650,000 Americans.
Okay. So, and I do think that that's an issue that is going to be driving voters. Okay, let's take a quick break here, Rick, and take a deep breath, because I want to read to you the latest statement from the former president of the United States, in case you have missed it, which I know that you have not. We'll be right back.
Oh, goody.
We will be right back. If you're a fan of this podcast or any of our other podcasts here at The Bulwark, I really think you're going to enjoy our newest edition. It's called The Focus Group, and it's hosted by our own Sarah Longwell. Maybe you've heard Sarah talk about these focus groups that she conducts, but now she's actually sharing real audio from the participants. It's a great show, and I know you're going to love it. Again, it's called The Focus Group with Sarah Longwell, and you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you consume podcasts. Okay, we are back with Rick Wilson, who joins us again on the podcast. Okay, so Rick, I have to admit, it's day three or day four, whatever. I am still kind of amazed that there hasn't been more publicity and attention to the pro-coup memo that we learned about the other day, the John Eastman roadmap for how Mike Pence could actually overturn the election, the fact that I believe now that Donald Trump woke up on the morning of January 6th thinking that he was going to be able, he would be reinstated, that he was going to win this election, that we were going to throw out the votes of millions of Americans. And we now have it. They put it in writing how they were going to throw out these electoral votes, what they were trying to do. And it's day three. And it's like, I don't know, like the 10th biggest story, you know, below the, you know, latest missing attractive white woman thing, you know?
By the way, I've actually been in the swamp where that guy supposedly is disappeared to.
He's dead.
I promise you.
Yeah.
He's either hiding out somewhere else or he's like, on day four of being Gator Chow.
Yeah.
I've been back in there years ago.
I'm going for Gator Chow.
Yeah, Gator Chow. As we see the January 6th Commission slowly doing its work, and I think everybody else wishes it was happening a lot faster. What you see now is the dreadful reality of America's short political attention span.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because no one can seem to focus for even 5 minutes on the fact that the president of the United States, a lawyer, wrote a memo describing an illegal and unconstitutional methodology for overturning the 2020 election.
Yeah.
And the Trump people embraced that.
Uh-huh. Trump himself.
And furthermore,
all in.
Furthermore, there is a consciousness in the Trump world. There will be a person or persons, including Donald Trump himself, and I believe Meadows, almost certainly, who both had a hand in the John Eastman coup memo camp, or foot in the John Eastman coup memo camp, and also with the Stop the Steal people.
Sure.
I think there's that Venn diagram will overlap, and it will show you that this was a conspiracy at the highest levels of government to overturn the 2020 election. Now, will Americans give a shit? The ones who think that January 6th was a tourist visit, well, maybe not. But the rest of America is still shocked by January 6th. They're still repulsed by it. And it's the real question. Democrats should be – one of the reasons they should be nationalizing this – because it's white Benghazi, people.
Well, also, it's ongoing. Yeah. See, this is the thing. It's not like, hey, let's move on because that happened and we need to do other things. No, the thing that really strikes me is the fact that they were deadly serious about overturning this election, more so than I think even those of us who were alarmed understood, that Donald Trump really wanted to have Republicans take this line and disenfranchise tens of millions of voters without waiting for audits, without waiting for any evidence. There were no competing, slates of electors for Mike Pence to count. They were going to do it, but he was clearly very disappointed that his fellow Republicans would not go along with it. But he is in the process right now, aggressively, of creating a Republican Party in his own image that would be more than willing to do it the next time. So it's not just what happened, it's what will happen, right?
Charlie, I have a phrase that I use a lot. A coup attempt that goes unpunished is a training exercise.
Yeah, well, you're right.
And the fact of the matter is, the fact that degenerate Roger Stone is not in jail right now, and Ali Alexander and all the other people that were involved in the Stop the Steal play, and all these scumbags who were bringing people in on buses. I mean, Charlie Kirk is probably going to have some exposure on this because his organization got a whack of money to bring people in on buses down to D.C. as the cannon fodder, the shock troops of this thing. I still believe that the criminal conspiracy to overthrow the United States government is something we ought to respond to. Call me crazy. Call me too stern. But I'm a big believer in treating people who want to overthrow your government with a certain degree of severity. And we haven't done that yet. Yeah. And the fact is, the Trump folks are counting on their media ecosystem preventing their voters from ever thinking it through. And they're right. Okay, let's be real.
Right.
They're not going to get out of the Fox bubble. They're not going to get out of the Facebook groups that tell them that January 6th was secretly Antifa. They believe that shit. It's done. It's over. We're not going to win that battle with those people. And I think it's important that the January 6th Commission press forward as hard as they can and to show as many of the connections as they can.
I actually think that it's worse than the scenario you just laid out about the people who believe that it's an Antifa thing. I think that you have a large number of Republicans who know that it was them, that was their guys who attacked the Capitol and did all that, and have convinced themselves that it was a good thing. It was, in fact, yes, we did it. And it was a good thing. Mm-hmm. We were the patriots. We should have done this. We should have been stronger. And that message is coming out unambiguously from Donald Trump. This is the other thing. It's like, you know, we talk about short attention spans. You know, we have the president of the United States issuing statements, making it very clear that he is endorsing this attack, that he is in solidarity with the people who attack and beat police officers. We now have the memo of how he wanted to unconstitutionally overturn the election. And again, it's like, what, are we just too exhausted? We just moved on. I know there's a lot of other stuff going on, but I mean, it's right there.
It is right there. It is as obvious as you'll ever see anything in this world. And unfortunately, I believe the Democrats lack the political bottom to really want to do what they should do. They should be investigating the members, the Republican members who were involved in this, and not just like get their phone records. They should be targets of this investigation because honestly, there are many of them that I have a very strong suspicion were active participants.
Oh, yeah.
And if we find that out, we ought to be in a position as a country where we're not putting up with it. Those people should be expelled from the House, frankly. Those people should face you know, as much sanction as can be brought against anyone else. If these people were Muslim terrorists who had stormed the Capitol, we would have stacked bodies 10 deep already.
It was very interesting that George W. Bush actually made the link on 9/11 between, I mean, that was oof, and now he's coming out, you know, solidly in favor of Liz Cheney. Okay,
I would not categorize that as a mistake on the former president's part.
No, no, not a mistake.
Very clear signal.
Okay, so here's my treat for the day. This is the statement from the former president that I know that you will, you know, enjoy. I know you've read it, but it's worth doing. He issues a statement after this book comes out, the Woodward Costa book comes out, that says that Mike Lee and Lindsey Graham had looked at his claims of fraud and basically decided they were bullshit. Right. And there was nothing to. So this is the former president of the United States. I almost feel like we should have like theme music behind this or something, but not. Okay. I spent virtually no time with Senators Mike Lee of Utah or Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. Welcome to the bottom of the bus, Lindsey. Talking about the 2020 presidential election scam, or as it is viewed by many, the, quote, crime of the century, unquote. Lindsey and Mike should be ashamed of themselves. So, I mean, come for the insanity. Stay for the bashing of
abject
Lindsey.
Humiliation.
Abject. His, yes. Please, sir, may I have another? Lindsey and Mike should be ashamed of themselves for not putting up the fight necessary to win. Which, of course, was laid out in the Eastman thing, how you use your power to overturn an election. Look at the facts that are coming out in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and other states. There are no facts coming out. If this were Schumer and the Democrats with the evidence we have of election fraud, especially newly revealed evidence, of which there's none, they would have never voted to approve Biden as president. And had they not, all of the mistakes that were made over the last month, which are destroying our country, capitalized, would not have happened. Mike Lee, Lindsey Graham, and all the other Republicans who were unwilling to fight for the presidency of the United States, which would have included at least an additional 4 Republican senators, 2 in Georgia, 1 in Michigan, 1 in Arizona, what the fuck, are letting the Democrats get away with the greatest election hoax in history, dash, a total con job, exclamation point. One more paragraph. Now he goes on the rant. We are losing our country. Country capitalized, exclamation point. The Democrats are vicious and fight like hell, and the Republicans do nothing about it. Rhinos fight harder against Republicans than they do against Democrats. They want to be so politically correct, like following the law and shit like that, even if that means losing our country, capitalized, which is happening now. Now, I love this next sentence. The evidence on determinative and wide-ranging election fraud is staggering. That's kind of a tell, isn't
it? Ooh, determinative. Yeah. I see a lawyer visited with them before this went out.
Yeah, yeah. We kind of know that, you know, the orange guy did not write that sentence, okay? Your Republican presidential candidate won in a landslide, oof, but has so little backing from Republican quote-unquote leadership. They should be ashamed of themselves. Why don't they have hearings? Or even if just Republicans had open public sessions, we would all hear the irrefutable facts. Another teller. Remember, the fake news media does not report the truth, exclamation point. So just a reminder that the man who's the former president of the United States is deep in this swamp of insane delusion. And memo to Republicans, no matter how much forelock tugging you do, no matter how much ass kissing, no matter how much obsequiousness, it will never be enough.
It's almost, Charlie, and call me crazy if you've heard this before, that everything Trump touches dies.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing will ever satisfy him. There's no boundary, and they don't get it. They all think. And you and I probably had many of the same conversations in 2017, the beginning of 2017.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, don't worry. We're going to normalize the guy. He's, you know, the office will change him. We've got smart people there. Paul Ryan's in the House. He'll take care of it. Oh, we're going to have this. We're going to bring this guy to heel. We're going to make it work. He's going to be fine. Well, they all failed. because they never understood that Trump doesn't respond to any of the cues or motivators of a normal human. He is insane. He is egomaniacal in a way that cannot be described in the English language. And he will do anything to retain or gain power. And I have some bad news for all the eager young Republicans, Ron DeSantis and Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and all of them who are dreaming of their super shiny 2024 presidential campaigns. Get fucked. Because if Trump is alive, he will be the nominee.
Which is really extraordinary. Because all of those people kept saying, okay, well, it's a binary choice. We have to go along with Trump because we want judges, because we don't want Hillary and everything. Now they have a chance. They have had chance after chance after chance to move on. Get the same judges. Get the same whatever it is that you actually claim to want. And in private, they're all going, okay, the guy's crazy. He's nuts and everything. But we can never say that in public. And as a result, he's just going to slide back in there, isn't he?
You know, I read this book by Franz von Papen recently.
Oh, I did too. I read the same book. I know the book.
You know what I'm about to say.
Yes.
Go ahead. In the 50s, and von Papen was as responsible as anyone for normalizing Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
For telling the as Hitler, he was vice chancellor, but for telling the German political class, listen, We can shape this guy. We can get this guy in line. We can make this work. But there's a line in the book, and he says, you know, even now, if we hadn't had Hitler, the German working class might have become communist. So I don't know about you. I'm no fan of communism or socialism, but I would say better red than 100 million dead. And this is the same mindset about this guy. And none of these people. They think they're in on a joke in Washington. Yeah. They wink and they nod behind the scenes. They mock Trump. Because look, let's be honest. While the majority in the House of the Republican caucus are pro-Trump, there's still 30 or 40 people that go to Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, and they whisper, "You're doing a great job, man. Thank God for you doing this." But I can't say anything because my primary might be bad. But there are people like Lindsay who will never stop touching the hot stove. They love power and the allure of the raw, you know, political exploitation Trump was willing to engage in. It has a deep and kind of sick appeal in human behavioral psychology that the transgressive person has power because they are unbound.
You know,
well, all of them are going to learn a lesson that power in Trump's hands will always be abused.
Yeah, and that is part of the thrill, right? Is that we are, you know, we are transgressive. You know, we can do anything now in this particular moral or amoral universe. So back to Franz von Papen. You just read the book just a little while ago.
So
it's all fresh for you.
It's making the rounds right now.
Okay, so I read it a couple of years ago, and so you're really touching my erogenous zones here because I really did think that, you know, when, you know, Hitler goes to power and everybody talked themselves, well, don't worry, Franz von Papen, he'll control him. He'll be the guy in charge and everything. And Franz von Papen looked the other way and enabled and rationalized much of what Hitler was doing. And even after he realized that Hitler was a monster, he kept coming back. And after a certain point, it was the night of the long knives where they actually murdered his top aide. You know, he's going, "I'm done. I am done with this." And then they came back and they said, "Oh, come on, you know, don't you want to be part of the team?" And he got lured back in again and again and again. Mm-hmm. Almost the perfect example of somebody who, you know, knew better, but decided he was going to make this Faustian bargain and rationalized it. And kept, you know, lowering the bar of what was acceptable. So even after the killings, even after surely after they murder one of your closest friends, you're going to break with him. No, Franz von Papen stuck there pretty much to the bitter end.
If Lindsey Graham walked into a room and found Donald Trump, you know, wearing nothing but a Speedo and covered in blood with dead hookers all over the floor, he would still walk out and go, "Well, I'm sure there was a reason. This guy Lindsay may be like the apotheosis of this crap, but they all have to make the same decision. do I stand or do I kneel? And they all kneel. They all kneel.
Yeah, and with Trump, you're either at his throat or his feet, right? I mean, you yep. there is no middle ground. See, Lindsey, what would Lindsey say in that particular case? He would probably say, "Okay, I'm done." But then within 24 hours, he would say, "Well, yeah, but let's talk about Teddy Kennedy." Well, yes, but right. let's talk about well, right. you know, lots of right. people have murdered hookers, and you know, and really right. the murder.
I mean,
of
who
hookers
among us
is,
hasn't? Yeah. Who among us hasn't?
Yeah,
right?
And, yeah. you're just you're changing the subject because the real issue is, and then you know, insert something else. But the thing about Lindsey Graham, which is also interesting, is that clearly Donald Trump despises him. For his sick
of course he does.
That's the secret, is he doesn't, he's not grateful for everything he's done for him. He doesn't respect him. He despises him as ultimately, I think he despises almost all of his followers and has nothing but complete contempt for the people who have backed him.
That's right. That's right. Donald Trump is a person who, if you bow to him at that moment, if you break for him, you will never have standing with him again.
No, ask Mike Pence.
And ask Mike Pence, ask Paul Ryan, ask anybody. And he will always view you as one more of his marks, one more of the people that he was able to play or con or trick or rip off.
So Rick Wilson, I think we've managed to piss off everybody today.
I love that.
Yeah, that's what we do.
You know what, folks, if you're not pissed off at something, you're not thinking it through.
and just a reminder, we didn't promise you a safe space here for any of you. And if we triggered you, we're kind of like, sorry, not sorry, because that's what
sorry,
we're
not sorry.
Sorry, not sorry. Rick, sorry. Thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Absolutely, Charlie. Thanks so much for having me.
We'll have you back again soon. And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.